Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University and author of The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State, joins me to discuss the staggering number of U.S. military bases and how they contribute to our war machine, and how the Biden administration's pivot to China might be a troubling part of that same dynamic.
And Heather Digby Parton will help us break down all the top news items of the week. Hey, folks, thanks for listening. You can help this program survive and thrive by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, but you also get extra content. This week, with all this craziness about reconciliation, a conversation I had about 2 weeks ago with David Dayan about reconciliation. He explains this process and what the final bill could look like if there is one. And you can get access to that by becoming a member today. Check it out, ROFpodcast.com. Thanks for listening. So, Heather, here we are. We've been waiting for this week for quite some time. And in some respects, we're still waiting for this week. We should say, and this is relevant because for scheduling reasons this week, we are recording this Thursday mid-afternoon. It's going to play on Friday. And you and I anticipated that by this time, we would know what the status was of the planned vote by the Democrats on the bipartisan infrastructure framework bill in the House. As of this very moment, we don't know. And so we're going to, you know, full disclosure, discuss it in that context, because this is, I think we both thought that Nancy Pelosi would have had to have made some type of decision at this moment. And it's fascinating. We might as well start there, because we also have the government shutdown that was averted. That is obviously important to talk about. And we have the debt ceiling, and I'm not quite clear on what the next step is for the Democrats regarding the debt ceiling. I think you have some ideas. But what do you make of what we're seeing today? There's three scenarios, right? And I guess maybe we should just lay those out before we go forward. One scenario is Nancy Pelosi says, I'm not bringing the vote to the floor because I don't have the votes. Because we know that at least, I think publicly, about 24 progressives have said, we're not voting for this bill without the reconciliation. Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Progressive Caucus in the House, basically has said that there's closer to 50 who are willing to vote against it. And there's been actually a Tonko came out on Wednesday, and who is not a progressive member of the a member of the Progressive Caucus. And to be honest, let's be honest, there's about 50 members of that Progressive Caucus who are probably not really progressive either, but Tonko came out and said he's not going to vote on it. So this was becoming sort of a landslide type of situation. You had all quadrants of the party. She could come out and say no vote. We're going to postpone it. When's the vote going to take place? Not sure. She could come out and say we're having the vote. Take the vote, and the bill is sunk, assuming the Republicans don't join the Democrats, which I think is a fairly safe assumption. Or the third scenario, she has the vote, the progressives cave, they all vote for it, and that's that. Start with the third scenario. If that were to happen, what would the implications of that be? Because that to me seems it would be catastrophic for everyone.
Well, it would be ridiculous. I mean, that is, I think, what the political establishment would assume would happen. is that the progressives would give in and say, well, we really need the infrastructure. We got to get those jobs and, you know, blah, blah, usual thing. And they're often in the past have been held hostage to these kinds of, you know, negotiations and votes. And in the end, they were sort of assumed to be the fall guy in this, and that they would take the heat and they would go ahead and vote for it. I don't think that's, yeah, I mean, yes, where we sit right now today, it is possible that could happen, but I honestly don't see it. I think that the progressives understand that they do have leverage. And there's another part of this, which is that this bill is basically the highway bill, kind of what somebody called it, a souped up highway bill. And they are, you know, this is not essential to be voted on today. Now, there is a little wrinkle in that there was, and Pelosi did a little, you know, kind of back room juggling with some other funding. Half of the funding for this bill is actually ongoing funding. That's just this, that's funding of highway people who work for the highway department, that sort of thing. And so she sort of tagged it to this date, saying, well, look, if we don't do that, if we don't pass that bill on this date, then all that funding's not going to be there and people aren't going to get paid and blah, blah, blah. And we really need to do that because we don't want any lag time. Well, that's ridiculous. They can just do an extension and it'll be fine. That's an easy pro forma vote to fix. I don't think the progressives are going to fall for it. They're much, you know, the progressives in the House right now and the leadership of the Progressive Caucus, they're a much savvier group. Yes. It's, you know, Pramila Jayapal and Katie Porter, people like that, who understand, you know, the idea of how to leverage your power in order to achieve your goals. So I will be surprised if that happens. I just don't see it. My feeling is that it will be and should be number two, which is that Pelosi just postpones the vote. This date was arbitrary. It was demanded by one guy, you know, Josh Gottheimer. I can't remember what his district is, but
New Jersey,
who, you know, for a number of reasons, apparently, you know, was just
he's
making
a hedge funder.
He's a hedge,
he's a hedge funder, and he was trying to leverage. I mean, the reason why they wanted to set this date, and let's be clear here, they wanted to strip it away from the reconciliation bill. Because they don't want to vote for the reconciliation bill. That's the only reason why you would do this. It's because you no longer, that once the bipartisan framework passes, there is no leverage anymore for Joe Biden, for the majority of the Democratic caucus, to force these corporatists to vote for raising taxes, to vote for providing services, negotiating prescription drugs. There's no leverage for them to sink it anymore because they need to need the bipartisan bill to pass so they can go home to their districts and say, we did something.
Right.
And so when the Gottheimers of the party are saying, hey, if we don't get this vote on Thursday, the 27th, we're not going to vote for the reconciliation. Everybody's like, well, if you do get the vote on the 27th, you're also not going to vote for the reconciliation bill. So whatever, dude, like we're all going down in the ship together. That's basically it. We're either floating together or we're sinking together.
And that really is the argument. That it's just that. It's like it's all in. It's all together or we all go down together. And, it's, you know, it's a risky play, but this is the kind of thing you have to do with a narrow majority because there's just no room. And certainly in a place where there's no Republicans, even remote. In fact, the bipartisan bill, the Republican leadership is whipping against it. So even people who voted for it before are now being whipped to not vote for it. So there's no hope that there's going to be. You know, in the old days, maybe you could get a few Republicans from a northeastern state who'd, you know, vote for a highway bill, but that's not going to happen. So this is the kind of thing that you know, you have to sort of expect on some level. But it's also that, you know, these people, this there was absolutely no reason for them to insist, to defy the leadership, the White House, you know, the Democratic Party, all the polling on the reconciliation bill. It's popular. It will be popular. There's no reason for them to do this. They are, and in fact, it's politically stupid for them to do it, because they get, you know, if they pass the bipartisan, if they vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, it doesn't insulate them from attacks for being tax and spend liberals or whatever it is they're afraid of. The Republicans will say what they're going to say. So, you know, the best thing they could do is to just do the right thing here. I mean, that's a good rule of politics anyway, but it's certainly true in this situation. So I don't know where this is going to go. Obviously, we're still sitting here, you know, today. We'll know by the time this airs. But
I am convinced that we won't know by the time this airs. I think Pelosi is going to postpone the vote. It seems impossible at this moment that the progressives will fold. If the progressives fold at this point, let's put it this way. If they do fold at this point, it is over. Like, they can never, ever claim to do anything again, right? They've been really coming out strong. They cannot. In the alternate, though, I will say this. It is going to change the calculation of the way that the Democratic establishment going forward is going to have to sort of like contemplate these things. You know, I think if Nancy Pelosi had thought that the progressives would and, you know, like, again, it's not just the progressives, it's the, you know, refuse to sort of vote for this. If she had thought that a month or two ago, we may have had these fights a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Because I think they operate in a system where they just assume this is the game, that this is what the progressives do. They you know, make a good case and try and do their best, and then that's it. And it's not happening in this instance. And I think there's going to be a lot of benefit for progressives down the road, even if there's no bill. And like you say, when we're talking about the bipartisan, you know, we hear this number $1.5 trillion. I mean, it really is closer to $500 billion of new spending. The other $500 billion, like you say, is the highway bill, essentially. And there's no reason to believe this other $500 billion can't get passed some other time. And, you know, we're talking about 50, you know, we're not talking about, this is not $500 billion that's dropped in 1 year. This isn't the defense budget, which is $760 billion. So this, from a policy standpoint, I don't know what the politics are in terms of passing a bipartisan bill. I don't know anybody cares about that. But from a policy standpoint, it's going to be a wash. They don't vote for this. They're still going to be able to do this at one point.
Right. And I think that one of the things that this may have been a miscalculation on the part of, you know, the corporate Democrats and maybe the Democratic leadership. This is not the kind of bill that you can really, you know, put the screws to the progressives on. This is not, you know, a healthcare bill. It's not something where, you know, it's not about, you know, food stamps or something, you know, Medicaid, something where, you know, actual people are going to be immediately impacted. That's the kind of thing that always tears the progressives apart. If you're trying to really put the screws to them, do that. This is, you know, I mean, I'm not saying it isn't important. Of course it is. You know, infrastructure is important. There are bridges falling down and you got to pay for these things. And this is something, and I think it will get done just like you say, but this isn't what, it doesn't really go to the heart of it. So I think the progressives have, this is a good opportunity for them to exercise, you know, flex their muscles here. It's a much bigger and more, you know, potent kind of cohesive caucus than it's ever been in the past. I mean, in the past, it really didn't operate as a caucus. They weren't like the Freedom Caucus in the House, right, or something like that. I mean, they were just a group of people. Anybody, yeah, I'm a progressive, you know, when I want to be and not. But now under this new leadership, there, it's a real, you know, cohesive kind of ideological caucus within the Democratic caucus.
Yes. And, you know, I interviewed AOC maybe a year ago about, and this came up, and she said, look, you know, there's no requirements to be in the Progressive Caucus. Like, they don't take a survey and say, like, where are you on Medicaid for all? Where Medicare for all? Where are you on paid parental leave? Where are you on free college? They don't have a list of things that you need to subscribe to. You just decide that you want to associate yourself with that brand. It doesn't mean that you're willing to vote. And when Jayapal took the sort of solo leadership, I think they made a point of saying, like, we're going to make it, if you're not actually progressive, it's going to be a little bit painful for you to be in the progressive caucus, because you're going to be put in some awkward situations. And so this is a good thing in that regard. I can tell you, I am, monitoring right now, and I am seeing nothing. The last we heard from Pelosi was that at about 11:30 a.m. on Thursday, she was still planning to call the vote. She said it would be impossible to convince the Democrats to pass the bipartisan thing unless they could be convinced that the reconciliation will happen. And of course, what's in the reconciliation is also sort of like an issue here. And lastly, she said she will not call the vote if she doesn't have the votes. And I don't think it's going to be close. All right, well, let's take a break. When we come back, let's talk about the other sort of major crises of the week, which was a government shutdown, which appears now to have been averted. But we have a debt ceiling situation, which is it is one of just the dumbest. I don't know. I wish there was a more articulate and, dignified way of saying it. It is just one of the dumbest things that one could imagine in our government, that this is a crisis when we are facing a pandemic, when we are facing climate change, when we are facing actual crises. That they've invented one, essentially. And we seem to go through this every couple of years. It's really unbelievable. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with Heather Parton. So, Heather, during the break, we were just talking about reporting that came out today that Joe Manchin had proposed a deal to Schumer. And apparently Schumer and Manchin signed the sort of like the document that said, here's the deal. And it's just a top line number of $1.5 trillion. And it said that you cannot bring a reconciliation bill before October 1st. And you start to wonder, hey, why was it September 27th, the date? Well, maybe it was because Nancy Pelosi or there was some hanky-panky afoot here that the House was forcing a vote on this before October 1st. And in the Senate, Joe Manchin was forcing a vote to happen only after October 1st. And so their idea to sort of decouple these things has been in the works, apparently, since over the summer. It really is fascinating how much the sort of like the deal making is blowing up here. Somebody around Joe Manchin is leaking stuff. I remember we had that audio of him calling, talking to the No Labels people and basically saying like, hey, if any of you, millionaires who are hiring some senators leaving, maybe if you sweeten the pot for them when they come work for you. It gives you a sense of what Kristen Sinema might be up to, right? I mean, nobody can understand why she is obstructing this in this way. It doesn't seem to be, honestly, outside of like getting a sort of, one of these sort of like paid no-show jobs at a corporation that might be, maybe a pharmaceutical that doesn't want to have to negotiate its bills. I mean, it's drug prices. It's hard to imagine what she's going to get out of this when it's all said and done.
I agree. There have been hours spent trying to understand Kyrsten Sinema. I think people have a better sort of grasp of Joe Manchin. I think he's more like a Joe Lieberman guy. He has a certain sense of himself that is a little grandiose, I would say. But
the incentive structure is different too. Like Joe Manchin's not going to pay a political price for this at all.
He could take the whole bill and he'd be a hero back home.
Kyrsten Sinema is going to pay a price.
I think so, but I think she has the opposite belief. I think she sees that, I think, and this is just my personal opinion, and everybody's got one, you know, what does Kyrsten Sinema really want? But my feeling is, you know, she's not a stupid person. She, even though she acts in this weird, incomprehensible way, she, you know, she was valedictorian when she was 16 years old. She got a PhD while she was in, I mean, she's a, you know, an intelligent person, but I think that her political, I don't think she has a political center at all. We know that she was
right.
A Nader.
She started as a Green, right? Yeah.
She was a Green and then just, you know, overnight became a centrist Democrat. And I don't think she has any real, you know, political ideology. This is purely about her own personal ambition. And I think she thinks that she can be, I think she literally thinks she can be John McCain Maverick, and that she can, that she will attract enough independents, conservative Democrats, and maybe some Republicans to continue to win in a state like Arizona. I think she's wrong. I don't think Republicans, they will applaud her for doing this, but they're not going to vote for her. And I don't, Democrats will shun her. So I don't think that she's going to achieve what she thinks she is, but I think she sees that she's carving out some, you know, niche for herself as this kind of independent, mavericky kind of person. She wants to be the thumbs down person.
You know, but what's amazing about that calculation is it is almost like the same calculation that Joe Biden, maybe they didn't really make it, maybe they just paid lip service to it, although that the Republican Party, never mind the electeds, that the voters make some type of calculus that where she's, you know, they appreciate her for being a maverick. The Republican primary voter is going to vote her out so fast.
Oh, my God.
I mean, she could switch parties tomorrow, and she very well may.
Sure. I think that's on the table, actually.
It seems like almost like her best move at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't care that she's an incumbent. She's going to lose in a Republican primary. There's just no way. And I mean,
you don't even want to think about the bloodbath there. Right. I mean, they went after McCain, remember, in his last election.
Yes.
They pretty much, you know, they almost took him out.
The president of the United States got to be president by literally trampling all over him. And I have no problem with that, frankly. I mean, John McCain, as far as I'm concerned, nominating Sarah Palin, might as well have been literally the midwife for Donald Trump when he was born. The Kyrsten Sinema thing is completely in insanity. And we don't know how that's going to play out. But I think the bottom line is that, like, you know, one of the things I know that you've noticed is the media seems to be like constitutionally incapable of understanding, or they understand it. They just want to make this about progressives versus moderates. And the bottom line is, the progressives are the ones who are supporting the president's bill, period, end of story. This is rogue corporatists trying to take down Joe Biden's agenda. It's amazing to me that's the way that they are, right? Like, you know, when you think back to, you mentioned the Freedom Caucus, it was always like, poor John Boehner. He's being held hostage by these right wingers. Well, where's the narrative of poor Nancy Pelosi's being held hostage by these corporatists who don't want to tax billionaires?
Who are playing essentially the same role.
Exactly.
I mean, they want to put the progressives as playing that role, but they're not. They're the majority. They are representing the Democratic Party. They're the mainstream. That the mainstream of the party. I mean, this is literally a handful of people in the House. And two senators with a few kind of, you know, whispering in their ear, I'm sure. But nonetheless, two senators who are up front. I mean, this is a tiny minority of the party in Congress and out in the country, if you look at the polling. So, you know, this is ridiculous. And I do not understand. You know, this is like the press just has a need. I don't know why their loathing of progressives continues to this day, because considering what they've just been through with the Republicans and what happened to the Republicans with that kind of insanity. I mean, look at the difference between the you know, what they perceive and portray as a radical left wing in the House of Representatives, which is basically trying to do things like, you know, provide child care and free community college. I mean, this is their radical agenda compared to the Republican radical agenda, which is basically at this point to destroy democracy. And to me, that trying to both sides this thing, and say, well, you know, both sides have, you know, their radicals are in charge. It's insane. The radicals are the people who are enabling the Republican Party. And that is right now a handful of House members and two senators in the U.S. Congress. They are enabling the Republican Party. And if this whole thing crashes and burns at their hands, and it may very well, we don't, you know, I have no way of knowing how this is going to come out. It's very, very fluid. But if that happens, that is the result. The result will be that they will have enabled the Republican Party. I mean, we haven't talked about the debt ceiling, but just briefly, the fact that these people are playing chicken with the debt ceiling is insane at a time like this. I mean, the economy is teetering. It has been since the minute COVID came on. We're still kind of dealing with all of that fallout. And here they are, basically Mitch McConnell going, we don't care. I mean, they essentially saying they're filibustering the debt ceiling so that they're just saying, we don't care. You know, you do it, you handle it. And what they're trying to do is gum up the works on reconciliation, force the Democrats to, you know, put the debt ceiling through a reconciliation bill, which requires a lot of rigmarole that will take up time. It will eat up a lot of the time they want to use for their other priorities, et cetera, et cetera. That's bad enough. The other side is that they're filibustering it. If the Democrats would get rid of the filibuster, this would be a non-issue. The Democrats could say, okay, fine, you know, and move on. But they won't do it. And this is where Mitch McConnell has Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. He says, I pray for them every night.
I don't doubt it.
You know, he did. He's quoted saying it. I pray for them every night. And, you know, they care about what's right for this country. So to me, they are operationally, you know, objectively pro-Trumpist Republicans. I see no difference because that is what they are working towards. So we're looking at this debt ceiling thing could really roil the markets because we're already in a situation where things are a little bit dicey in the market. Yeah. And this could be a big problem. Okay. And it's insane.
We got just about a minute left here. In the reconciliation, if they put the debt ceiling in, do they have a separate reconciliation bill? Okay, so it is not going to go into the $3.5 trillion bill. Although
it could. If they put it into the big bill, then they open it up to all. They got to do the Votorama again. They've got to go through all that. To me, it makes sense to do that because
it becomes a must vote for bill and
for Manchin and Sinema. You're going to crater the world economy. I mean, to me, that seems like
I'm with you on that. There's some people who think that Manchin wouldn't vote for it at that point, but I'd like to see him try it.
Yeah, really. Said also, I mean, he has been very clear. Look, the debt ceiling has to be raised. I don't see how he goes for it. And, you know, look, they could be operating good faith on that reconciliation bill and say, okay, Joe, we'll bring down this, that, and the other. And, you know, we're going to try and accommodate you here, but this is what we have to do. And they could even say it. We don't have time to do anything else.
Right.
We have to do it all together. So I don't really understand why they're resistant to that, but maybe that's part of the game because Biden came out and said, no, I don't agree that you should get rid of the filibuster for the debt ceiling. And I'm thinking, why would he say that? And the only thing I can think of is that he's trying to jam the whole thing into one fell swoop. I can't understand why anybody would do that otherwise.
Heather, I thought this was going to be resolved this week, but it's going to we're going to be back next week and we're going to be talking about it. Hopefully we'll have some resolution then or at least some clarity. But always a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
In the wake of the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan, which was commendable, and then at the dawn of their pivot to China, which is concerning, there is a shift happening right before our very eyes in the United States' foreign policy. But it's not one of systemic demilitarization. It's merely a new focus. And the limitations of that approach, I think, should concern some people because the sheer breadth of the United States' military presence around the globe will shock you. Here to talk about this is David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University and author of The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the Islamic State, who wrote an excellent brief for the Quincy Institute alongside Patterson Deppin and Leah Bolger entitled Drawdown, Improving U.S. and Global Security Through Military Base Closures Abroad. Welcome to the show, David. Really appreciate you being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Emma. It's great to talk to you.
Of course. So 750 military bases in 80 countries. Your brief talks about that. And I don't think people understand how abnormal that is and how insane and bloated and expensive, and also I think how much that incentivizes military conflict to continue because there are all these branches. So I guess let's just start there. Talk about the sheer number of military bases throughout the globe.
This is little known in the United States. It's really the face of the United States in many ways overseas, that the United States possesses 750 military bases outside the 50 states in Washington, D.C., that is in other people's lands, in 80 countries and colonies, as you put it. I think it actually helps to picture some of these bases. They range in size from small, what are often referred to as lily pad bases, to bases that are the size of small or really not so small U.S. American towns called Little Americas frequently, or America towns. And these are tens of thousands of U.S. troops, tens of thousands of family members, schools, hospitals. And I think we should think about the infrastructure in our own communities here in the United States, infrastructure that's so often crumbling, roads, bridges, schools, and then try to picture in your mind, if you haven't seen one of these bases abroad in Germany or Italy or Japan or South Korea or Honduras or on and on, try to picture huge city-sized base that we're investing $55 billion in a year. And that's just to maintain these bases, to keep them running on an annual basis without the costs of the personnel that staff them and work on them and that serve on them. That brings the total that we're spending to maintain bases abroad to well over $100 billion, billion with a B, a year. Compare this to all the other militaries on Earth. The United States probably has more than three times the number of foreign military bases compared to all the other militaries on Earth. The United Kingdom has a large number, but probably around 145 by the latest report. Russia and France have far fewer, maybe three dozen among them. And then a few other countries have a handful. China, for example, has five foreign military bases, five compared to 750 U.S. bases abroad. One other comparison that just puts this in perspective, and I think drives home where the focus of our foreign policy has been for far too long. There are 276 U.S. embassies, consulates, and missions around the world. Compare that to nearly three times as many U.S. bases abroad. The focus of our foreign policy has been on war making, on building bases, on maintaining huge numbers of bases and troops around the world, really since World War II, and that's what has to change.
So I want to return to that five figure for China when we return to talking about the new Biden administration posture towards China. But I want to expand or ask you to expand on the World War II historical point, because that marks one, a massive shift in the United States on the global stage, right? We were the dominant world power, and I say were in the past tense because I believe we are currently witnessing an empire in decline for a lot of the reasons we'll lay out today. But that was the shining moment for the United States and an opportunity for them to expand their global reach. And that seemed like the moment in which these military bases multiplied to the degree that we're seeing now.
No, that's absolutely right. The United States has had foreign military bases on other people's land since shortly after independence, initially on Native American people's lands that enabled the conquest of territory across North America and the expansion of the United States. But on a global scale, it's really during World War II that the US military builds a collection of foreign military bases that had never been seen in human history. A larger collection of foreign military bases, truly around the globe, more than any people, country, or empire in world history. And after World War II, a goodly number of these bases closed, but the United States military maintained a permanent infrastructure of bases on other people's lands. And this persisted throughout the Cold War, going up and down during the wars in Korea and Vietnam. But when the Cold War ends, you might think, oh, well, these bases that were such a component of the strategy of the United States facing off against the Soviet Union in the Cold War, you'd think that the bases could have closed. And many did, about 60%. But again, upwards of 800 bases at that time, sometimes numbering more than 1,000 after the end of the Cold War, remained in place. The basic infrastructure of bases remained in place. And actually, since the end of the Cold War, the breadth of US bases abroad has actually doubled. At the end of the Cold War, there were about 40 countries hosting US bases abroad. Now there are about 80 countries and colonies hosting US bases abroad. So while the total number has shrunk since from about 1,600 to now 750, currently by our best estimate, the breadth of these bases, the spread, the geographic spread of these bases has grown dramatically.
Did that happen during the Gulf War? Was that a part of the new neocon project under Bush in particular, Bush 1?
It's happened in a few phases. The first, with the George W. Bush administration, indeed, expanded the breadth of U.S. bases in the Persian Gulf in particular, in the greater Middle East, to support the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, to support parts of the war on terror throughout the globe, though we see a major growth of U.S. bases, smaller mostly, but not entirely, in Africa, in parts of East Asia, Central and Eastern Europe, including in the Obama and Trump administrations. So it's really been a bipartisan policy, again, since World War II, but in the post-Cold War era, it's continued to be a bipartisan policy. Again, well, as our report shows and argues, to the really damage of the United States, these bases that so often are portrayed for far too long have been portrayed as necessary to protect U.S. and global security in a whole variety of ways are undermining U.S. and global security in ways that we outline in our report.
So I'm going to ask if you could expand on some of those ways. The environmental impacts were something that I had never considered before that you touch on, but there are other ways in which the these bases and the sheer number of them do harm the United States. And I try to frame foreign policy conversations in a way that affects the globe, but the only way you get to talk to United States politicians is to frame it in the way, how is it going to hurt us? So let's talk about how it would hurt the United States, or how it does hurt the United States to have this kind of bloated presence.
Let's talk first about the money, the $55 billion a year. Again, just to maintain the bases themselves, not the troops, just the bases. That's a budget that's larger than the size of the State Department's budget itself. And again, shows the distorted priorities we have when it comes to engaging with the world and pursuing a foreign policy. So we start there. We have to think too about the ways in which these bases cause what is frequently referred to as blowback. The presence of bases has been a fantastic recruiting tool for militants like Al-Qaeda. Guantanamo Bay is the most prominent case in point. But even before the attacks of 9/11, Osama bin Laden for years was railing against the presence of U.S. bases and troops in the Muslim Holy Land, in Saudi Arabia. This became a rallying cry for Al-Qaeda and similar militant groups in the post-9/11 era as well. So bases have a tendency to actually cause more harm in a whole variety of ways. Bases are also found in at least 38 non-democratic countries. So these are countries that are led by non-democratic regimes, frequently repressive, murderous regimes, including most of the countries in the Persian Gulf region, where U.S. bases are actually supporting undemocratic governments and regimes and blocking the spread of democracy, contrary to some longstanding claims that US bases are spreading democracy. There are a whole variety of other ways that, that bases harm local people, including the environmental harm that bases cause. Basically, bases wherever they're located are not good for the environment. And if you think about what military bases are, it's easy to understand. They store large stockpiles of dangerous weaponry, hazardous materials, chemicals. And just by the very storage of them, their damage can occur, but there are also a long track record of both accidents and sometimes intentional dumping of hazardous materials and other environmentally damaging materials. So this is a well-documented track record around the world. Again, not winning us very many friends. Accidents, other kinds of accidents, as well as crimes committed by US military personnel on bases abroad have also spurred protest. Coupled with, you know, you can probably, I think it helps for people in the United States to imagine how would we feel if a foreign military had a base in our town or city, wherever we might live in the United States.
Right.
How would it feel to live next to even a British or a French base, let alone a Russian or Chinese base? Would we want, you know, high-powered weaponry stored by a foreign military near where our homes? Foreign military bases, wherever they're located, tend to irritate local populations and cause protest, damaging the reputation of the United States in the process. And right. That's just the beginning.
Well, I mean, the only thing I think Americans could think of as analogous potentially is the current way that heavily militarized police forces occupy largely black neighborhoods. And the obvious and understandable resentment that at least thoughtful Americans can point to and see why this has caused such animus and such resentment, you can extrapolate that and think about a military base that occupies a country that heightens tensions and does not make a home feel like a home in many ways because of their presence. So that's, I think, a useful way for some people to look at it potentially. We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more specifically about the Biden administration, their foreign policy, and how it relates to your attempt and our attempt here to refocus the way that Americans view our foreign policy. We'll be right back. So one of the things I found really fascinating in your brief with the Quincy Institute was the emphasis on how the number of military bases encourages wider conflict because of just their sheer presence. If we're weighing a diplomatic response, oh, well, we already have a military base in X place in this country. And it just, it makes the convenience of conflict more convenient. It's even more convenient. And that's why I found the Biden administration's withdrawal from Afghanistan to be so monumental and important. Because every incentive structure in the United States, and also, by the way, in the way that the press covers military conflict, because their sources are in the intelligence community who will feed information that favors conflict because they are invested in such, there are a variety of apparatuses that encourage conflict. And the Biden administration, to their credit, really bucked those. So I guess we can talk about the good in how they responded and how they chose to say, I'm not going to cave to the pressure of these institutions. But then we'll talk about their shift towards China, which I find scary.
I do as well. But you know, you pointed to a number of the other ways in which US bases abroad undermine US national security and global security that I didn't get a chance to touch on. Most importantly, the way in which these bases abroad have served as a launch pad for wars. The catastrophic last 20 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq and 23 other countries. Most people don't know that US combat troops have been in a total of 25 countries far beyond Afghanistan and Iraq alone.
People have no concept of how involved we are in Africa, for example, which is something we also should be paying attention to. But continue.
Indeed, beginning with Somalia and Libya and the disastrous wars waged there, the presence of this huge infrastructure of U.S. bases abroad made it all too easy for policymakers to choose war as a policy option. And the result has been 20 years of disastrous war that have cost US taxpayers, just the wars alone, $8 trillion, and that's trillion with a T, taken the lives of 4.5 million people, 4.5 million people, 38 million people displaced in the 8 most violent wars the United States has been involved in. The infrastructure of bases has made this possible. And actually, as my book, The United States of War, shows, has actually made it more likely that policymakers would choose war. I think you also pointed to another danger of this huge infrastructure of bases, which is that while frequently proponents say that these bases are necessary because they deter enemies, they actually tend to only encourage anyone who might be portrayed as an enemy, for example, China or Russia, to respond in kind, to build up their own military forces, and in some cases, foreign military bases. Although, again, no other country on earth has even close to the number of foreign military bases the United States does. But again, I think it helps to think, how would US leaders, how would US citizens respond if China or Russia were to build even a single military base near the borders of the United States? Now, mind you, again, they don't have a single military base near the borders of the United States, while the United States encircles both China and Russia with hundreds, literally hundreds, of foreign military bases. And one of the troubling things about this recent deal alliance with Australia and the UK is that it, and few people have been paying attention to this, it is creating a new military buildup of US bases and troops in Australia, further encircling China. Again, if the shoe were on the other foot, if China or Russia were to build even a single base near US borders, I think you'd see US politicians and ordinary citizens calling for a military response. And that's what military bases tend to do. They tend to escalate military tensions and cause an upward cycle of militarization and frequently arms races along with them. Again, tremendously dangerous because of the potential for setting off not just a Cold War, but potentially a hot one. Now, you pointed to Afghanistan and the importance of withdrawing U.S. forces and U.S. bases from Afghanistan, which I too supported. But it really was insufficient because of the huge infrastructure just in the region alone. Similarly, with the announcement of this really terribly named AUKUS deal.
AUKUS.
Or Triple Alliance.
A-U-K, so again, the U.K. and the Australia and then U.S. at the end.
Yeah. This, what I'm referring to is the Triple Alliance, which really reflects not just Cold War era thinking, but a kind of 19th century thinking. Mm. It's really going in the opposite direction of the positive signs we saw from the Biden administration in withdrawing from Afghanistan. What it's calling for is not just the submarine deal that that most of the media attention is focused on, a deal to sell Australia nuclear-powered submarines, which is, we should pay attention to it because it's quite dangerous in its impacts on nuclear non-proliferation, namely that the United States, almost certainly, or perhaps the UK, will be transferring weapons-grade, nuclear weapons-grade, highly enriched uranium to Australia as part of the deal to build submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, for Australia, which could end up fueling nuclear proliferation, not just for Australia, but for other parts of the world as well. But again, what people haven't been paying attention to is that the nuclear-powered submarines are only a small part of a much larger military buildup that the United States and Australia have agreed to, where the United States will be building up its U.S. base presence in Australia, as well as its forces, air forces, naval forces, land forces, while also agreeing to deals on weapons development, including hypersonic weapons and electromagnetic weapons, spying, space activities, cyber activities, and even a mining deal. So this is a much larger buildup that, most dangerously of all, is really as close as we've come to a formal declaration of a new Cold War against China as we've come to this stage. I mean, I think many people would agree that we're in a Cold War already. This is a near formal declaration of that Cold War, and that alone is tremendously disturbing and dangerous.
I have so many responses, and I wish we had more time. I could talk to you about this for forever. One, I think we don't even need to guess what the United States would do in response to a military base being at our border. Just look at our posture towards Cuba because of a perceived ideological alliance with, with the communist ideology that could provide a threat to us because it's so close to our border. And I mean, we can just see it there. And then in regards to China and this deal, and I appreciate you explaining how it's a lot bigger than the media has, I think, or the top line headlines of the deal have been articulated, is the fact that this is basically a direct declaration of, okay, this conflict is not just going to be about two competing economic systems, even though we exist in global capitalism and these corporations are multinational and this seems silly, but that is what we're going to do. It's going to be a military one. And you mentioned at the start of our interview these five military bases that China has. This is going to encourage China to ramp up its militarism. And it shows the limitations of Biden's worldview, in my opinion, because if one was truly trying to end the endless wars, which is what he said at the United Nations, he would do what you're advocating, closing military bases, but they still want to have their cake and eat it too, the United States. We want to be the big bully on the national stage, but not as big of a bully as Trump or as Bush. We want to still have the option to have our hands all over the globe, but, you know, not necessarily do a systemic overhaul, which is exactly what's necessary, not just for world peace, I'm not just a hippy dippy, which I certainly am, but for the preservation of the United States, because this is untenable. This is not able to continue in the way that we need to, especially when we're going over retreads of Cold War foreign policy with Russia. And let's just like tack them on to China as a way to have a new enemy that everyone can get rich off of, including defense contractors and including industry, when rivalry breeds capital.
I couldn't agree more, although I think it's not one key amendment I would make is that everyone won't get rich. The weapons manufacturers, as you said, they'll get rich. The beneficiaries of the military-industrial complex, or what Eisenhower initially termed the military-industrial congressional complex, they're going to laugh their way all the way to the bank, just as they have on $8 trillion that have been spent on war since 2001. The buildup of US forces in Australia and a near formal declaration of a Cold War against China is going to be fantastic for the weapons manufacturers, for the military industrial congressional complex, if we don't stop it, which we must stop it, because as you said, this is untenable. The endless wars will continue. And that's my greatest fear in the wake of Biden appropriately and long overdue withdrawing from Afghanistan, that the United States is going to end up in yet another war. We are still engaged in some endless wars in Iraq and Syria and Yemen in some ways, among others. But the United States will end up in yet more wars, and most catastrophically of all, could end up in not just a Cold War with China, but a hot war that could potentially be a nuclear war that should be really unthinkable to all of us. The two most powerful nations on earth going to war, both nuclear armed powers, the catastrophe of the last 20 years could look small in comparison.
And
that's,
I know that
we have to stop.
Yeah, and I know for some people that may sound hyperbolic, but it's not. We're not saying that Biden is going to start the war, right? I don't think that that's realistic. But when you create this framework for a Cold War and you set it up in the way that he's doing right now by creating this infrastructure in Australia, you set the table for a crazy, and we know another crazy is going to get elected because of the way the Democratic Party operates, and we haven't had any real voting overhaul, and gerrymandering is going to continue. You set the table for someone like that to do exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think even under a Biden administration, we don't know what will happen, especially with, you know, aggressive military exercises that the Biden administration, like the Trump administration, have been running in East Asia. The potential for even an accidental clash with Chinese military forces is there on a near daily basis. And yeah, there's nothing about this that is hyperbolic. We should really be afraid, especially because we are, in my mind, reaching a point of no return on a Cold War with China. And I think folks should ask themselves, do we want a new Cold War? For those who lived through the first one and saw trillions of dollars wasted, squandered in a war that nearly brought us to global Armageddon through nuclear war, do we want that again for those who weren't alive during the Cold War? Do we want yet another endless war that's going to cost even more trillions of dollars, squandering it and stealing that money from the real human needs facing us, from building a green infrastructure that could save us from global warming, from protecting us against pandemics, from erasing global hunger and hunger in the United States, homelessness? That's what is at stake when we escalate military tensions with China and really solidify a Cold War that could be disastrous for the United States and disastrous for the globe.
Right, right. And I have a lot of fears about that as well. I did not live through the Cold War, but I have a lot of anxiety about the lack of understanding in the Biden administration and the Democratic Party as a whole about the colonial nature of our foreign policy. And there still is such rose-colored glasses about how we are a democracy and we are not like our oppressors in Britain when we actually declared independence. No, this is very, very similar, and we're living through it today.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. I mean, that's another aspect of the alliance, the triple alliance with Australia and the UK, that hasn't been commented on enough. And this is colonial behavior. It's 19th century behavior in a bunch of ways, including the way in which alliance structures led us into World War I. But it's also colonial. And, you know, these three white leaders, male leaders of Australia, the UK, and the United States standing up and saying, we're going to control what's going on in Asia. I mean, this is racist, this new alliance, this triple alliance, and should be profoundly troubling to all of us for that reason alone, let alone the danger of creating this new Cold War that could very easily become a hot, potentially nuclear war.
And again, last thing, that is why that anti-China bill that was passed in June, pet project of Chuck Schumer, had bipartisan support. That's why these people who were so concerned about Russiagate and it being a hoax and said, oh, it's going to start a new Cold War, are silent when it comes to the actual Cold War that's happening in front of us because, oh, well, there's Chinese people involved. I don't really care so much about us being in conflict with them.
Which also shows how this policy is going to fuel anti-Chinese, anti-Asian, mm-hmm. anti-Asian American sentiment and racism that is already on the escalation.
Yeah,
already
absolutely.
Excuse my
no, of course.
Word salad.
Yeah, that's me on a daily basis. David Vine, professor of anthropology at American University and author of The United States of War, A Global History of America's Endless Conflicts from Columbus to the United to the Islamic State. And you can read his brief at the Quincy Institute called Drawdown, Improving U.S. and Global Security Through Military-Based Closures Abroad. David, thank you so much for your time. I love the conversation today.
Emma, thank you. Really appreciate it.
That's it for this week's Ring of Fire podcast. Hey, if you're listening to the free show right now, you're missing all the bonus content our members enjoy on a weekly basis. Go to ROFpodcast.com now and become a member. It's your support that keeps us moving forward. On behalf of Emma Vigeland and Heather Parton, I'm Sam Cedar. Have a great weekend.
Now walking back down this mountain, the strength of a turning tide. Oh, the wind so soft at my skin. Yeah, the sun's so hot upon my side. Oh, looking out at this happiness, I search for between the sheets. Oh, feeling blind, but realize all I was searching for was me.